Revelation 21, we'll read verses 1 through 6, and then we'll jump to 22 through verses 27. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away." And he who was seated on the throne said, "Behold, I am making all things new." Also he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." And he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment." Verse 22. And I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. And the city has no need of sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light. And its lamp is the Lamb. By its light will the nations walk. The kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. And its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. They will bring into it the glory and the honor of the nations, but nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life. That is the word of God.
We've defined worldview, like your worldview is the story that you have of the world, right? So your worldview, how you view the world, is your story for the world, your narrative for what's going on in the world, and then how you make sense of your life in it. What does it look like for you to be a participant in that story? Here's my question for us this morning. Here's what I'm wanting us to look at. How does that story end? How does your story, your worldview, your narrative for the world end? How does it end? And maybe even more importantly is this, is your life right now affected by, in some way, like in some form, in some fashion, like something in your life now is affected by how you see the story ending? Is the end of the story shape at all, affect at all, the chapter that you're in right now? Right, the page that you're on right now, is it affected at all by how the story ends? That's what I want to get into. That's what I want to look at. That's why looking at the end of the Bible story is so unbelievably important for us to really have a full understanding of what our worldview should be. We need to know how the story ends, right? So, have you ever had a vision for heaven, right? Not one of the weird visions for heavens where you have to like write a book because you went to heaven, right? That's not what I mean. And like an experience, right? You had an experience and you experienced it and you were like, I think heaven is a little bit like this, right? Heaven should be a little bit like this. Have you ever had that? You ever had anything like that? So for me, it was a couple of years ago. It was just a trip. My wife and I and my girls, we went to Newport Beach, California, okay? Because if heaven is a lot like something, it's probably Southern California, and probably not Northern Texas, okay? And so we go to Newport Beach, California with my girls and my wife, and my mom came as well. And I just remember this one moment. It was like the first day, maybe it was the first morning, but we were on the beach and we were looking out at the Ocean, Pacific Ocean, just depending on your geography, I want to tell you, Pacific Ocean, right? And I just remember being in awe of the beauty and power of the ocean, and then thinking about how beautiful and how powerful God must be that he would speak that ocean into existence. That just by his very word, it came to be. That verse in Job came to mind, "Thus far shall you come and no farther. Here shall your proud waves be stayed," as God just commands the waves of the ocean to come no further. I'm just amazed. And I'm there with my girl, right? My best friend, my baby, my girl. She's awesome. She's the most beautiful, most talented, she's the funniest person I know. And I'm there with her. And then I'm there with my girls, but I also brought my mom because there's free babysitting in heaven, I imagine. And I imagine free babysitting in heaven. And so I get to be with my girls, but then I get to not be with my girls at times as well. And we're just enjoying Southern California. And it was this pastor's retreat. So you know, brought the kids, but it brought the mom as well so that we could be a part of this pastor's retreat, this conference, where there's 500 pastors and their wives from all around the world. We're part of the Acts 29 Church Planting Network as a church. And so every year I go to this pastor's retreat. And so we all get into this room, right? And we're singing worship songs. 500 pastors and their wives from all across the world. If you've ever experienced something like that, it's 1,000 people from all over the world singing, you know, "How Great Thou Art." And this year it was a gospel worship band, and so there's lots of dancing and clapping and singing, and the white people are trying to clap on beats, and they're not really sure when to clap, and we're trying to figure that out, and everybody's singing, and all this like beautiful, like just beautiful music and beautiful voices are happening. And I just was thinking, heaven's got to be a lot like this. And then we ate, and we ate like kings, right? I'm talking about fish and sushi and steak. Just ate like kings, like different tastes. And there was red wine, and it was an Acts 29 retreat, not a Baptist retreat, right? So there's red wine, and there's flowers, and there's vibrant colors, and the flowers and the plants and all this stuff was just blooming and beautiful, and you're just thinking, heaven's got to be a little bit like that. Have you had something like that, right? Just an experience, a multi-sensory, relational, musical experience. We're just like, man, I think heaven's got to be a little bit like this, a little bit like this. Have you ever had that? Or maybe here's a different perspective, a different way of viewing it. Have you ever had an ache for home? You ever just been homesick? It was the freshman year, you know, first semester, and you just want to be home. Or it's the tail end of a long business trip, and you've been away from your family, and you've just got this aching, this longing for home. Have you ever had that? That's what I want for us this morning. I want us to have a vision of heaven, just an aching, longing for home. I'm going to tell you, man, that's going to be really hard for us because we're Americans, and it's really, really comfortable in America. And it's really easy. This lifestyle, this life that we have, it's pretty easy. And so it's really hard to ache for home, right? It's really hard to long for something better because this is pretty good. But the times that we do suffer, the times that there is an injustice, the times that there is grief or pain, like those times are a gift to you, American Christian, okay? They're a gift to you from God, an imparted ache in your soul for home. That's what they are. And so if we could just have, just for a moment, like just 30 minutes here, if we could just, and I can't produce it, I mean, the Bible maybe can, the Holy Spirit maybe can, but if just for a moment we could ache for home, and we can have a vision for how this story ends. If our worldview is our story for the world, well, how does this story end? And maybe that can help us right now. Maybe that can comfort us right now. Maybe that can do something for us right now. That's what I want to do. Now, how you view what home is really important, though. So back to my first question, how does the story end? How does the story end that you have of the world, your world view? How does it end? If you ask different people who have different worldviews, who have different religions, who hold to different philosophies, the end is different for them than it might be for you, right? So I'll give you one example from the Buddhists, right? So I've got a buddy, we support him as a church. He's a missionary in the Far East, and he ministers to a lot of the Buddhist community. And so he's really helped me understand the beliefs and the practices of the Buddhist community. And so here's their story and their end of the story. It's basically this, that they believe, and this part's probably is true, that we're in this constant cycle of sin and suffering, right? That's what Buddhists believe. And so what we need to do, or what the Buddhist needs to do, is be perfect, live perfectly, and rid themselves of desires, because it's desire that leads to sin, live perfectly so that they can get out of this cycle of sin and suffering. That's what the Buddhists would believe. Now, they would believe that eventually, at some point, potentially, if enough life cycles have happened, that you could move out of these different, what are called celestial abodes, right? There's 31 celestial abodes. Four of them are hells, right? So four hells, and then 27 other celestial abodes until we get to nirvana, right? And so if we could be awesome, be perfect, then maybe we can get there. Now, most of them don't believe that that's possible at all, right, to be perfect. And so what they'll try to do is really just commit themselves to five basic things. Do not kill, do not steal, do not lie, do not commit adultery, and don't get drunk or gamble too much. That's basically the idea, okay? And then they'll try to atone for the times where they don't, right? So it's called merit, right? Make merit. So they will give money, they'll give alms to the poor, to the monks, to the temples, to idols. They'll try to do good works to work off their bad works in order to spend as least amount of time in hell as they can. Okay, so their life is basically a perpetual hell of sin and suffering, and eventually, maybe, if they're good enough, they can move out of one of those hell abodes. Most of them don't believe that it'll actually happen. They just try to do the best that they can so they can spend as least amount of time in hell as possible. That's their story. That's their story. Now, that's the Buddhist story. Most other religions and philosophies and worldviews are pretty much the same thing with just different language. Okay, if you've ever thought, well, they're all religions are alike, you're right. You're right, they are. Here's how all religions and philosophies and worldviews are. Here's the story and here's the end of the story, okay? It is man is at the center of the universe, right? Man, humanity is at the center of the universe, and humanity has to work towards heaven, okay? Whatever heaven is for you, so it's heaven, it's enlightenment, it's nirvana, it's the American dream, right? Whatever it is for you, that's your heaven, but humanity is at the center of the universe and has to work towards, has to be moral enough, be successful enough, be reasonable enough, have enough reason, right? It be, you know, karma, whatever it is, get to their heaven, whatever their heaven is. That's every worldview, every philosophy, every religion that we have. We've seen that in our 13, 14 weeks in this worldview series. Everything we've looked at, right? Why do we buy stuff? We talked about this last week. So that we could work towards being better to our heaven, whatever our heaven might be. Our heaven there is the American dream, perhaps, right? Moral relativity. Why is moral relativity so appealing to us? I get to choose what's right and what's wrong. Well, because if I have to work to my heaven, it'd be really nice if I could make up the rules as I go along, right? All the things that we've looked at in this worldview series basically is us working towards our version of heaven. It's every other story. The gospel story is quite different, though. The gospel story has not you at the center of the universe, but Jesus at the center of the universe. Jesus is at the center of the universe. Jesus is the hero. Jesus is what everything is about. Jesus is the main actor in the story. Everything is about Jesus, and we don't work to get to Jesus. We don't try to be good enough to get to Jesus. No, God comes to us. God works to us. God gives us grace and comes to us. It's a completely different story. That's a completely different story. It's not we get to heaven, it's heaven comes down. Heaven comes down. So, How does that then shape and change the way in which you view the world now? How does that look then now if the end of our story shapes our worldview? What about the chapter that we're in right now? Shouldn't it shape that? Here, John Piper, he says this. Listen to this. The reason God revealed to us in the Bible what will happen in the end is that knowing what happens takes away fear. It takes away fear, and it fills us instead with hope and confidence and anticipation. And when fear goes and hope in God overflows, we live differently. We live differently. Our lives show that our treasure in God is more precious than anything else. We're not suckered in by advertising that says the one with the most toys wins. We don't devote our best energies to laying up treasures on earth. We don't dream our most exciting dreams about accomplishments and relationships that perish. We don't fret over what this life fails to give us. So how this thing ends is going to shape. It's going to shape. It should shape, rather, how we live our life now. And so I just want us to, for a moment, ache for home. Just for a moment, have a vision of the end, of heaven. What does it look like? What is it going to be like? Just for a moment, if we could have that, and maybe we can be comforted by this hope. So Revelation chapter 21. Revelation chapter 21. What does the end look like? Starting in verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Circle passed away. Had passed away, and the sea was no more. Now, some people say that this literally means there'll be no oceans and no beaches. I don't think it means that. What I think this means is that there will be no evil, okay? Sea is often a picture of evil. And so the sea will be no more. No, there'll be no more evil. That's what I think that means. Verse 2, and I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride. Who is this church? This is us, right? Yeah, this is us. This has always been the story. Isaiah 52:1 says, put on your beautiful garments. Isaiah 61:10 says that God has clothed us with the garments of salvation. He has covered us with the robe of righteousness. As a bridegroom decks himself like a priest with a beautiful headdress, and as a bride adorns herself with jewels. This has always been the story that we are a bride being prepared, adorned for her husband. That's what the church is, okay? It's always been the story, from the book of Isaiah to the book of Revelation. Let's keep going. Look at verse 3. As a bride adorned for her husband, and I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning. This has always been the case. Isaiah 50:35-10, it says that sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Isaiah 65:10 speaks of one day where there no more shall be heard the sound of weeping or the cry of distress. This has always been the story, that one day there will be no more mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away, circle passed away again. I want you to see how this has always been the story, okay? That this is the story that's been being written, okay? Isaiah 65:17 says this, for behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind. Isaiah 43:18 says, remember not the former things, nor consider the things of old. Behold, I am doing a new thing. Okay, so here's the big idea. God has given Isaiah a vision 2,000 years or so before he gave the Apostle John a vision of the same thing. This is the story that's being written. Here's how it's going to end. All things are being passed away and new things are coming. That's what it means. That's the vision that we have. And so the theme of the first four verses is obviously, because verse 1, verse 4, we circled it, that the old has passed away. That's the theme of the first four verses. The old has passed away. Okay, what has passed away? Well, evil has passed away, right? Death will pass away. Tears in the new heavens and the new earth, when this thing ends, will be no more. There'll be no more tears, right? Suffering will cease. God will dwell with us. So when it says that everything will pass away, here's what that doesn't mean. That doesn't mean that this earth will just be completely destroyed and we will go to some metaphysical, ethereal place called heaven. That's not how the story ends, okay? If you'll notice in verse 2, heaven comes down. Heaven comes down. Literally, we have heaven on earth. That's how the story ends. We have a new heaven, a new earth, a restored and renewed creation. We have heaven on earth. That's how the story ends. But I want us to focus on verse 1. Verse 1, where the Apostle John, who writes this book of Revelation, he says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth." He's been given a vision. He's given literally a worldview, right? It's a new worldview. It's a renewed worldview. He's seeing a new world, a new creation, a new heaven, a new earth, but he's been given a vision, right? He's been given a worldview. He sees the story. He sees how the story ends, and he sees, what he sees is no pain, and he sees no more death, and he sees no more crying and no more evil. He sees home. The Apostle John gets a view, a picture of home. This is an aching for home. I joke with first-time dads who leave for the first time, like leave town for the first time. I joke with them that the first night away is amazing, right? Like, it's just amazing. You can go to sleep when you want to, and when you fall asleep, nobody wakes you up. You know, no kid is crying, and your wife doesn't mule kick you to get you up to go change. I've heard stories about that. That's never happened to me. I've heard of somebody getting a Charlie horse in the middle of the night by their wife, who's, you know, really small and petite. Yeah, that doesn't happen, right? And you can sleep in if you want to. Like, the first night away is amazing. It's amazing. The second night away is horrible. It's horrible because you already miss home. You can't wait to be back. You're a first-time daddy, a first-time mommy. You just want to be back home with your kid, right? With your family. There's this aching for home. Some of you may have seen this video. I watched this video last week of the Sudanese refugee that got to see his family, be reunited with his family for the first time in 4 years. So the story goes, they fled, right? And they didn't bring with them any sort of proof of marriage. And so they sent her, she was pregnant with two kids, here to Fort Worth, but he couldn't go with them. So a church in Fort Worth takes them in. She's pregnant, two kids, and then it's 4 years later. And he finally figures out or gets worked out the, you know, whatever legal things that he had to do so that he can come. But he has never met his three-year-old son. He hadn't seen his wife in 4 years, his bride. He hadn't seen his two kids in 4 years. Man, I can't even fathom that as a daddy. They grow like that. They change like that. And to not see them for 4 years is like missing a lifetime. Just transformation and change and the memories and the experiences. But you're watching this video and, you know, it doesn't matter how big you are, how manly you think you are. You're crying, right? And you're watching this video and what I'm thinking, like I'm watching and I'm thinking, what could possibly be going on in this man's heart and mind on the flight there? I mean, how, it wasn't even his home, but it's home, right? Right? That's his family, that's his kids. What kind of aching to be with them must be going on in the pit of this man's soul? Right? Just this desire, this longing, like walking, you know, the flight lands and you're having to get, you know, your stuff down for the, and you're waiting for the line and you're finally walking out. Like, can you imagine what's going through his mind? The waiting, the longing, the anticipating, the desire, the aching to be home. That's what Revelation 21 is meant to do in you. It's meant to produce that in you. It's meant to produce in you this ache for home, this vision of heaven, because it's really hard for us. Right? He's writing this to persecuted Christians in Rome and throughout the Roman Empire. And for them, this is a great hope that one day this will be what they experience. But it was also inspired by God the Holy Spirit to speak to American Christians a couple thousand years later who are very, very comfortable. And it's meant to give you a vision of what's so much better. What's so much better than a few bucks in your pocket? What's so much better than another TV? What's so much better than whatever else that you may be experiencing or after or you bought last weekend or this weekend? It's meant to produce in you this ache for home, for something better, where the old has passed away and the new has come. It's inspired by God for that reason. It's an imparted ache. It's a gift of ache, right? To give you this vision for home. Here's my question. When's the last time you thought about heaven? I mean, think about that. Like, for all of eternity. So let's say, you know, your heaven, your version of heaven is different than my version of heaven. That's fine. For all of eternity, compared to the blimp on the screen that is our life, when's the last time you thought of it? You think about how much thought and energy, critical thinking, fretting about that you make of this day or tomorrow or next week or this life, and how little we think of eternity. Colossians 3, it tells us not just to think about it, but to focus on it. If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth. For you've died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, you will also appear with him in glory. We're to have a vision, a worldview of heaven. All right, let's keep going. Look at verse 5. And he who was seated on the throne said, who is this now? Who's that? I'm not going to be up here preaching and you guys don't participate. Who is this? Yeah, this is Jesus, right? Who sits on the throne? Jesus. Okay. So he who is seated on the throne says this, behold, I am making all things what? New. Circle new. Jesus is making all things new. In verse 2, you have a new Jerusalem. In verse 1, you've got a new heaven and you've got a new earth. This is a vision of renewal. This is a vision of renewal where everything is made new, okay? This is a worldview that's been given to the Apostle John of a world renewed, a world redeemed, a world restored, a world reconciled. And so if verses 1 through 4 are about the former things passing away, if that's the theme, well, the theme of verse 5 is now everything is new, right? Jesus is going to make everything new. Now, this is why this is important. So much of our story, so much of your life, chapter after chapter after chapter of it, has been you pursuing renewal. It's been you pursuing self-improvement and self-help and a better version of yourself. It's why we've done all the things that we do when it comes to this series, this worldview series. It's why we view the world in the ways that we do. Because page after page, is you pursuing renewal. Right? That's what consumerism is. Why do we buy stuff? To be better, to be renewed, to have a better version of ourselves, to feel better about ourselves, to look better. Right? Why is education not the biblical worldview? Why is it not that we would grow in our knowledge and love of God? Why is it why do we view it the way we do? Because we want to be a better version of ourselves. We want to get the job that we want to get. We want the adulation or the prestige of what we might accomplish. We want to be able to make the money that can buy the things that we want. And so we view education the way we view it. We view politics the way we view it. We view all of these things the way that we do, right? The way that we do, because we want renewal. We want renewal. We want a better life. We want the story to get better. We're wanting a better story for our lives. We want renewal. But who makes all things new? Jesus does. Jesus makes all things new. It's Jesus who can bring about renewal. And so we're supposed to have this vision of this renewal, right? This heaven, this new heaven and this new earth. Verse 1, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. Let's have a vision for it. Verse 5, he's making all things new. Let's have a vision for the renewal. Let's have a vision for heaven. Let's have a vision. Let's try to imagine it. Okay? This text, the first two verses, in fact, gives us three pictures. Three pictures by way we can try to imagine what this will be like. We see a city, right? The picture of a city. We see a picture of a bride or a wedding. And we also see a picture of a new creation, new heavens and new earth. Let's try to imagine what this new heaven and this new earth, this end of the story looks like. Let's try to imagine it. So first, through the picture of the city, this is our relationship with one another. See, what sin did is it fractured our relationship with one another. Because of sin, because of our rebellion, because of our selfishness, there's this divide now between us. But in the new heavens and the new earth, when the world ends, when Jesus comes back, what we see is that we see a holy city, a new Jerusalem. This is the church. And so we, as the church, will, in the new heavens and new earth, experience perfect harmony. All of the things that we're commanded to in Scripture in terms of how we treat one another, all of the one another's, we will do fully. We'll do fully. So church, you will love one another perfectly and always. You will always, every one of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another. All of the one another's, you will practice. You will be of the same mind with one another, all of you. We will be kind and tender-hearted to one another. We will honor one another. Every one of the one another's will be fully realized in this new city, this church. Think about that. That means no relational conflict. It means never again marital strife. That means no more racial tension. It means there's no bitterness, there's no resentment, there's no hate, there's no unforgiveness, there's no division across political lines or national lines or gender lines or socioeconomic lines. There's no division whatsoever. There's complete and utter peace. There's unity. Tolerance becomes love. We no longer just tolerate one another, we actually love one another. Why? Because we're home. Because we're home. Or think about the picture of the bride or the wedding. This is our relationship with God, right? Sin, it's fractured our relationship with one another, but it's also fractured our relationship with God. And so now we're a bride, right? Adorned for her husband. You will be fully washed by the grace and mercy of Jesus. Fully washed. There'll be not one sense of that weightiness of guilt. There will not be that one feeling, that bitter kind of grimy film of shame over you. There'll be none of that kind of feeling of sin. None of that will be over you. You'll have a clear conscience. You'll always know where you stand before God. Not this question of where do I stand. No, you'll always know. You'll never doubt him. You'll always experience the love of God in every which way, never once feeling distant from him. It'll be like the most beautiful bride on her most wonderful wedding day. It is the perfect day, the perfect moment, the perfect relationship between you and God, for between us, the church, and God. You'll be without spot or wrinkle or any such thing. You'll never feel lonely or afraid or insecure, because fear and loneliness and insecurity are all effects of our fractured relationship between you and God, right? There'll never be anxiety anymore. There won't be body image issues. There will be no eating disorders. There'll be no depression or anger. There'll be no fear. All of that will go away. It's the perfect wedding. A bride adorned for her husband. You'll lack for nothing, you'll need nothing, and your joy will be full. Why? Because you'll be home. Because you'll be home. Or what about this picture of a new creation? Right? There's going to be a new heavens and a new earth. This is our relationship with creation. Our relationship with creation is broken. Sin, it fractured our relationship with God and with one another, but also with creation itself. And so there's going to be a new heavens and a new earth, right? It's going to be renewed. You know what this means? It means no more disease. There'll be no more cancer, no more MS, no more CF, no more Parkinson's, no more Alzheimer's. There'll be no more disease. You will never once have to see another time one of your loved ones in pain. You will never once again grieve ever again at a funeral. That won't happen. If you're a doctor, a nurse, a PA, a physical therapist, if you're a pastor, for that matter, you're out of a job. Amen? You're out of a job. Yeah, it's all put back together. There's no more suffering anymore. Creation is put back together. But it also means this. It means even the things that we like about creation actually get better. They actually get, like sunsets, they actually get better. They're better. Ocean, it's better. Creation is subjected to futility, Romans 8 says. That because of the weight of our sin, that it's fractured creation, what we experience, even in the good things about creation, isn't quite there yet. Right? If the beautiful Texas painted sky could preach to you, would say, I know I look good now, but wait till he comes back. Right? The starry skies on a country road, man, how beautiful, nothing compared to the new heavens and the new earth. It gets better and better and better. The story gets better and better and better. We should have a vision, a hope for how this thing ends. One of my favorite verses is in Ephesians 2. It's in the middle of other of my favorite verses. It's a really good chapter. But I love it because it says that God, in his grace, will raise us up with Jesus, and he will seat us with him in the heavenly places so that through the coming ages he might show us his immeasurable grace, the immeasurable riches of his grace. Here's what that means. So for the coming ages, all of eternity. The coming ages is all of eternity. So for all of eternity, you will never probe the depths of the grace and mercy and majesty and power and kindness of God towards you. So all of eternity is not enough for you to fully know and experience all the goodness and glory and beauty of God towards you. You'll never get bored. You'll continually be learning new things and exploring more of the glory and majesty of God towards you. Jonathan Edwards, a great American thinker, best maybe American thinker in our history, he said this. He talks about this greater capacity for joy that we'll have in the new heavens and the new earth, that with our resurrected bodies, we'll be able to experience joy and pleasure exponentially more as our mind and body and senses and ability to reason all increase. So in the resurrection, when you get a new resurrected body, right, this renewed body, you're going to have a greater increase, a greater ability, a greater capacity to experience joy and pleasure. Think about the immense joy and pleasure, like the best, the most joyful or pleasurable thing you've experienced on earth. It is nothing compared to what we can experience in the new heavens and the new earth. And so then he goes on to say then that we will be enraptured with joys that are forever increasing and yet forever full. So we'll always be satisfied, but then there'll always be more to satisfy us. We'll never get bored. He talks about how our capacity, even in eternity, will continue to increase. In fact, Sam Storms, another theologian, says the same thing. He says, your capacity for love, knowledge, understanding, and yes, joy are ever expansive, progressive, and incremental. That you're constantly, in eternity, in the new heavens and the new earth, growing in your ability to experience joy and pleasure, and all the while experiencing greater joy and pleasure. And it never stops. You never touch bottom. You never get to the end and you're like, well, that's it. No. Why? Because we worship an infinite God who has infinite joys and pleasures bound up in him. You're never going to get bored. You can't exhaust yourself with an inexhaustible God. And so he closes this essay. He says, the pleasures of God are inexhaustible and unsearchable. Like the ever-expanding vastness of the cosmos, God will forever be out of your reach, while at the same time within our reach to enjoy. This is what awaits us. No more tears, no more suffering, perfect unity, no more insecurity, perfect knowledge of the love of God and the experience of the joys and pleasures of the universe that grow and grow and grow in the presence of God. Doesn't that make you ache for home? Doesn't that make your little shiny little trinket thing that you bought the other day, which is fine, no big deal, right? But doesn't it make it that more worthless? Your hopes, your passions, your dreams, your visions, man, praise God for those things. They're nothing compared to what we're going to experience in the new heavens and the new earth. They're nothing. All right, let's finish up. Verse 6. And he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage. I will be his God. He will be my son. But as for the murderers, the sexually immoral, the sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death." Let me just briefly explain verse 8, because we could get into it. I mean, you look at this list, and it characterizes pretty much all the different worldview things that we've looked at, right? I mean, you can look at this list and you can see consumerism and moral relativism and individualism and sexuality and tolerance and different things like that, right? So we could get into this and talk more about the different worldviews that we've already discussed, but I don't have the time. Here's what I would just say to this, okay? Here's what verse 8 means. It means if your worldview never changes, if your worldview never changes, if it never conforms to a biblical worldview, and if it's never the Bible gospel story that it gets swallowed up in, if you just kind of stick to your guns and you want to be the author of your own story and you want to be the main actor and you like you're good with that, you're satisfied with that, if that's how this thing goes down for you, then this is your ending. This is what happens. Okay? Some people like hate the idea of hell and they wrestle with its truth and they wrestle with it and why do we talk about it and all that? And I get that, and I get it. On one hand, I get that. On the other hand, though, it makes complete sense to me. If you reject God, you don't get God. And by reject God, I don't just mean reject the existence of God. There's most of us believe in God, right? What I mean by rejecting God is, I mean, you reject the centrality of God, the goodness of God, the beauty of God, the everythingness of God. You reject the grace of God, the love of God. If you reject God, then you don't get God. If you reject life, you get death. If you want to write your own story, this is the way that story ends, just like everybody else's story. You trying to work to something that you'll never achieve. And so, this is talking about hell. But the picture here is that these people in verse 8 are satisfied with authoring their own story. They want to be their own God. That's the picture here. And it's contrasted with the picture in verse 6 where these people aren't satisfied. In fact, what does it take to get the new heavens and the new earth? What does it take to get paradise? What does it take to get heaven on earth? What does it take to be in the presence of God? Do you have to be moral? Do you have to succeed? Do you have to work harder? Are you at the center of the universe and you're working towards your heaven? Is that the way that it is? No, the only thing that you need in verse 6 is to be thirsty. Right? You see that in verse 6? To the thirsty, Jesus says, I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. You just need to be thirsty. You just need to not want to be the author of your own story. You just need to want a better story that Jesus writes, where he's the hero. You just need to be thirsty. He gives to those who are thirsty the spring of the water of life without payment. It's free. It's a free gift of grace. The life, death, and resurrection of Jesus paid this price. It's a free gift of grace, this new life. You only have to be thirsty. But I want you to see the first part of 6 again, because all this worldview talk and story talk, it's really important to see verse 6 again. He said to me, Jesus, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. Listen, the story is about Jesus. Like, whatever your worldview is, if it's not centered on and seen through the lenses of the person and work of Jesus, you're not going to see the world rightly. The story is ultimately about Jesus. The fame of Jesus, the glory of Jesus, right? The beauty of Jesus, the majesty of Jesus. The universe exists for Jesus. He's the main actor of the story. He's the author and finisher of the story. The story is about Jesus, and you need to rightly see that. You need to see that. That's, you're talking about worldview, you're talking about how do I view this, and how do I view that, and I'm a Christian, so how do I view this? You have to view it through the lenses of Jesus. Jesus is ultimate. The story is about Jesus. So, does the end of the story then shape the page that I'm on right now? That's been my question, right? That was my question. Does the end of the story, does this vision for heaven, does this aching for home, does this picture of the new heavens and the new earth, does it shape the chapter that you find your life in, right? We're about to enter into a new chapter, right? 2017, can you believe that? It's not the Jetsons yet. I just thought it would be by 2017. Some of you can't wait for 2017, right? Because 2016 was tough. It was tough. So we're about to enter into a new chapter. Is today, is this season, is this chapter, is it shaped by, is it affected by at all the way that the story ends? The answer is yes, because you're not writing the story, Jesus is. Whatever suffering or trial or pain, whatever you're walking through right now, whatever difficulty, whatever pushback, whatever sort of loneliness or whatever it is that you're experiencing, here's what I know. What I know is that Jesus is writing that page, that chapter, with the end in mind. Knowing how this thing ends up, knowing what's going to happen in the end, he's writing today with the end in mind. Doesn't that comfort you today? Doesn't that bring you hope today? Yeah. Yeah, and if we're thirsty, he's got more grace. And, right, if we're thirsty, the waters of life are free to us without payment. He's good and he's gracious. He's given us this vision that we might ache for home. One day we'll be home. One day we'll be home.